Even if you don't immediately know her name, you know her books. Kate DiCamillo's first book, Because of Winn-Dixie, published in 2001 and was listed as a John Newbery Honor Book. And Kate DiCamillo herself has been giving readers of all ages stories that are heartfelt and hopeful ever since. The Tiger Rising, The Magician's Elephant, The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane, Louise, The Adventures of a Chicken, the Mercy Watson series, and the Newbery Medal Award-winning books The Tale of Despero and Flora and Ulysses, which puts her in a very distinguished club, as only 5 other authors have won 2 Newbery Medals. It is our great honor to welcome Kate DiCamillo to the first 50 pages.
I'm going to start this interview by saying that I was not fully prepared for what I would discover about myself while researching for this episode. If only I would have read Ann Patchett's New York Times essay from 2020, I would have known this, right? So just to quote Ann, she said that reading The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane changed her life. She writes, "I couldn't remember when I had read such a perfect novel. I didn't care what age it was written for. The book defied categorization. I felt as if I had just stepped through a magic portal, and all I had to do to pass through was believe that I wasn't too big to fit. This beautiful world had been available to me all along, but I had never bothered to pick up the keys to the kingdom." And that really hit me, you know, like... Because I've been a lifelong reader, but at a certain point, I think we give up children's books, you know, as adults. Yeah. And so my question, Kate, is why do you think that we as adults don't allow ourselves permission to read children's books?
Let's just take a minute to listen to acknowledge Anne's extraordinary metaphor there, which stops me every time. I was just big enough to fit through the portal. I love that so much. And it's so accurate. I can only answer in terms of myself and my own journey, which is, I live in Minneapolis and, I moved here, 30 years ago, and I got a job in a book warehouse that was down in the warehouse district, a book distributor. And I was assigned to the third floor as a picker filling the orders. And the third floor was nothing but children's books. And I knew I wanted to write when I got that job. And I was, writing short stories and sending them to literary magazines. But I thought, children's books, duckies and bunnies, right? So I just went around picking those books off the shelf. But as a reader, it was only a matter of time before my reading instincts kicked in, because I was just surrounded with these books all day long. And I started to read some of what I was pulling off the shelf. And one of the first books, novels written for kids since I had been a kid that I read was The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963. And it was life-changing for me, Christopher Paul Curtis, because it talks about something so important, but yet it's so warm and funny and accessible. And I remember thinking, I want to try and do something like this. So, I mean, would I be talking to you now if I hadn't been immersed in that world of children's books and as a reader, just kind of like push past that bias that we seem to have as adults for children's literature? I don't know. And I don't know how it happens. I just know that it's funny because people will say to me sometimes, when are you going to write a book for adults? And I feel like I have landed exactly where I'm supposed to land and writing exactly what I'm supposed to be writing. And that a lot of adults have found their way to me. And so I'm writing, maybe that's part of it, is that we think that children's books, are stop being relevant at a certain point, and they don't. And you rediscover it later on when you're reading to your own children, or I don't know. It is a mystery to me. But boy, do I feel lucky to get to tell these stories.
You know, I love this play as I'm reading your books. This play between the pragmatist and the romantic, or the cynic and the dreamer. They're just, it's just lovely. And so part of me thinks, you know, do we all become cynics as we get older?
I think, you know, and this is one of the reasons, as much as I can articulate it, that I love writing for children. And part of it is, it's a quote that I read from Katherine Patterson a long time ago, that you're duty bound to end a story with hope. And I didn't know that, but I felt it. I felt that duty. And then the other thing that I'm so aware of is that it lets me access what I think of as like a peripheral magic, and the only way I have to describe that is thinking about the borrowers. Remember the borrowers? Mm-hmm. You know, the people who live in the floorboards of your house. And it's that feeling that you have as a kid that if you turn your head slowly enough, you're going to see something magical. So yes, we become more cynical. We forget that feeling of wonder and awe, and that if we move through the world with our eyes wide open, we're going to see something that's going to astonish us. I think that we put all that down as we age because it hurts.
Yeah.
If you watch a kid move through the world, I mean, I've watched it be 25 below zero and a mother like getting a kid out of the car and going into the grocery store, and the kid sees something interesting on the ground and is looking at it when the wind is howling around and it's literally 25 degrees below zero. It's all interesting. It's all fascinating. It's all beautiful and awe-inspiring. And it is, you're just so open to everything. And I think that children's books can take you back to that feeling.
So you've got two new books this spring. Ferris, your latest book for middle readers, which the New York Times called in a recent interview a balm for the soul. Can you share with our listeners a little bit more about this story and how this book came to be?
I had a very troubled relationship with my father. He died in the fall of 2019, and then on the last day of 2019, December 31st, which would have been my father's 91st birthday, my best friend, her daughter gave birth to a little girl named Rainey, and so I was looking at these pictures of this beautiful child welcomed into the world, surrounded by her parents, both sets of grandparents. And it was just like, wow, this kid is gonna just never, she has just been loved from the minute she arrived. And it was so different than my dad's story on my dad's birthday, you know? And I thought, what if I wrote a story about a kid that just was enveloped in family and love from the minute that she arrived? And that's Ferris. And so that was the inception. And it was also, in a odd way, a departure for me, because I'd never really written about a complete happy family before. And writing these stories for the last 25 years has given me something, connected me to so many readers and to so many people, and made me feel a part of the larger family of light and love. And so I was able to do this, to give this to this child, Ferris. So does that all make sense?
It does. And I absolutely adored Ferris, and especially the characters in this book. They're just so, so good. You know, they're colorful, they're quirky, yet you know, want to know each and everything about them. And you really, like, come to care for all of them as you read. Pinky, oh my God. Every time she'd be on the page, I'd just be busting out laughing. I'd be like, oh, geez, what's Pinky going to do now?
She was fantastic.
You know, and then Charisse, and, you know, seeing the ghost, but just how she communicates with everyone in the family was so beautiful and touching. And just the dad reading the encyclopedia to calm his kids down, and just all of those little things you just latch onto and just are like, oh, I want to be a part of that family.
Well, which is how I feel too. You know, it was, writing is hard for me, and I'm always like, oh boy, let me get through it. Let me get through it. And this book was different in that way too, in that I was so sad to finish it because I wanted to stay with that family and in that house. So,
I mean, I got so invested, I even went to YouTube to listen to Mysterious Barricades that Billy Jackson plays on the piano throughout the book. I'm like, okay, I need to know what this is, and I need to go listen to it. And it was wonderful.
The whole book was written to Angela Hewitt playing that song over and over again on the piano. And so it was like writing it while Billy Jackson played it, you know.
So to bring things up, you know, back out of the emotional well a little bit, because I'll admit I did cry a bit while I was reading the book, not because it's that, you know, terribly sad, but my family had just lost one of our own beloved family members. So it was very cathartic for me reading this book, and had some ugly cry moments, but it felt very healing at the same time. So I'm not trying to put anybody off the book
joy.
At all.
There was joy.
There was joy in thinking, yeah, like, because my aunt was remembered in that fashion, similar to a character in the story that I will not name, because I don't want to give away any spoilers. It was very cathartic. So,
oh, I'm glad. And, you know, it's like I remember, I don't know how many times, because I rewrite so much, I typed those last words, and every time they devastated me in a good way. You know, I sobbed only at the end, but again,
yeah,
and again, and again. You know?
Oris and Timble is your other new book. It's the first in a new series for early readers that explores the unlikely friendship between Oris the rat and Timble the owl. And my personal opinion is that this book is one that will stand the test of time.
What a lovely thing to say. Wow.
Well, it is beautifully illustrated. And is it Carmen Mock? Is that how
we pronounce it? Yeah.
The illustrator. Yeah. Fun details and the themes of friendship, kindness, courage, and storytelling will leave young readers ready for the next book. And it's a book I think that adults will find joy in reading too. So my plug is, if you're looking for a gift book for a new reader, this is the one. Like, it is lovely. And I can't wait for the next one.
this was totally... this is a pandemic baby, these characters. And I needed, I very consciously needed to comfort myself. And I very consciously was like, I need something like Frog and Toad. And Frog and Toad, nothing's ever going to be Frog and Toad. That is the Holy Grail. I understand it. But I wanted to get into that kind of feeling. And I consciously was like telling, you know, this story of these two friends as an homage to Frog and Toad and to comfort myself. So it really matters to me that you think that that it will last.
Oh, I do. You know, kids love the Mercy Watson series, and it is so fun because you hand it to them and they're like, well, I don't know. And then I love when they come back and ask for more, you know, like, I want the next one. I'm like, of course you do. I knew you would.
You're like, I'm not going to tell you I told you so because you're a child, but I'm going to think it. But
it's funny, but with Mercy Watson, I remember when I wrote the very first one of those, and I sent it to my agent, and she said, I don't know what this is, but I like it. And then she sent it to Candlewick, and they said, we don't know what this is, but we really, really like it, and we'll figure out a way to make it work. And then what happened was, you people, librarians, are like, oh, we've been waiting for something like this, because it kind of bridges the gap between, you know, novel and easy reader. And so it was you librarians putting it in kids' hands. Thank you. That's what made Mercy go.
Well, and you know, even, you know, write picture books. So one of my favorites is I mentioned it in the biography, even though it's probably not one that often gets mentioned in a biography, but Louise, The Adventures of a Chicken. It just, I love it.
But not so chicken. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that book. But even, you know, you have this beautiful picture book, I'm going to get the title wrong because I didn't write it down, but it's just one word, and it's this girl's kind of journey, and she's just singing to herself in French, you know, and it's about friendship and so many lovely things, but there's really no words in the book, but it's a beautiful story.
Yeah, it's that longing for connection, you know, and Jamie Kim's beautiful, beautiful art just like is deeply moving. And you're right. It's not, I mean, you can say there's a, I guess, law, you can play the word law in Scrabble. So therefore it is a word, but it's like, it that's it. It's, you know, it's more a syllable, and Jamie Kim's art turns it into this powerful, you know, it was just that trying to get to that connection, you know. And what I love about La 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 is that the, you know, a kid who cannot read can read that story to themselves.
Yeah.
And feel that, you know.
Can we talk for a minute about the magic that comes to us when we first learn to read? And, you know, what are the stories that you remember from your childhood that unlocked that magic for you?
Yeah, I, you know, in talking to my mother, and it's funny because I wish so much that I had been able to say this to her before she left. She died in 2019. And I, as I referenced earlier, struggled with phonics, and phonics were the way that we were taught to read. This is in 1970, 1969, and Claremont, Florida. And I was a kid desperate to read, and I was presented with phonics, and it made no sense to me, and it terrified me. And I remember coming home and saying to my mother, I was like hysterical. I can't do it, and I need to do it. And, you know, and she said, for the love of Pete, in her inimitable way, why don't you just calm down? She gave me two wonderful messages here. She said you're smart, and that was great to hear that, and two, we'll figure out a way to work around it. And the implicit message there is everybody's brain is different, right? And so she used flashcards, and every day after school I would just come home and memorize the words. And so it was my mother who taught me how to read, and I don't know what that, it, maybe that's whole language approach, I don't know, whatever it is, it worked for me. And I remember it was Little Bear. I can never say her name, Elsa, you know, with illustrations by Marie Sendak. But I read that book, and I remember exactly where I was sitting. And I was like, this is it, man, out of my way, people, as Pinky would say. You know, I that was it. I knew it was what I needed. And that was the first book that I read on my own. And I thought, now, watch me go. And that's courtesy of my mom. And my mom was also so spectacular about taking me to the library all the time and buying me books. and just paying attention to me as a reader.
So is there a particular way that you try to shape your stories, or do you even consciously do this or unconsciously do it so that you can connect with young readers?
Yeah, no, if I consciously tried to do it, I would mess it up terribly, I think. It's the same way I feel about, you know, outlining. I can't figure out in advance what's going to happen. I can't think about, will this make X, Y, or Z reader happy? I can only kind of like get out of my own way and let the story tell me. I always feel like the story is smarter than I am. And so it's just that thing of putting down all of my defenses and following the characters in the story.
Well, whatever you're doing, it's phenomenal. And I would just say, keep doing what you're doing.
Whatever I'm doing, I'm the luckiest person in the world to get to do it. I mean, I say this to kids sometimes, that it is an astonishing thing to find what you're supposed to do in the world, right? And then to get the chance to do it, because a lot of people don't get the chance. They might know, but they don't get the chance. So I found what I'm supposed to do. I got the chance to do it. And I make my living from it. It's just like, it's unbelievable to me.
And you have been honored with so many accolades in your writing career, yet you continue to be accessible to readers, staying active on social media, inviting readers to book talks and events. And just a plug, there are more coming up, so check Kate's website. But in a sea of so many connections, what are the moments that stay with you?
Well, what I'm flashing on right now is just what it's like, you know, when you're doing an event and the kids come through the signing line and you get to talk to each one of them and how moving that can be. Or I was just out on, I'm going to see if I can get this written up for Facebook. I was just out on a walk this morning and I love it that kids will talk to me. And a kid said to me, I just read, when are y'all going to air this? Because I want to tell the story on Facebook.
It'll probably be at least a couple weeks.
Okay. I just read that book of yours about the big lamp. He said to me. And I said, the big lamp? And he said, you know, the big lamp hanging over the table. I said, oh, the chandelier. And he said, yeah, I read that book. Uh-huh. And that kind of thing, that kind of connection, to be walking through the world, to like, to talk to a kid who has read the book and remembers it as the big lamp book. What a wonder, you know, it's just so much light. And connection. And, you know, it's, it just makes me feel like a part of things. So.
And when you are so beloved as a storyteller and author, there, of course, is bound to be criticism and backlash from time to time. Mm. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, well, one of the ways I deal with it is not ever, you know, I will read what my editor sends me as far as reviews go. I don't look at anything about myself online ever. I don't, you know, and I think, you know, in an odd way, it's kind of like, the praise can be just as distracting as the criticism. Mm. And here's another visual metaphor for you, that the, you know, the Newberries are actually, which y'all know, actual medals. And I keep my Newbery medals in a drawer of my desk at the very back of the drawer. And every once in a while, I will pull that drawer slowly, slowly open and look and see if they're back there and then slam it shut. And because it's just like I have the words of my best friend always in my head. It's not about you, pumpkin. And so that goes for the criticism and the praise. It's just my job is to tell the story the best that I can and to try to connect to people through those stories and with my heart. And the rest of it, I just have to I try not to pay attention to.
And what a gift to have those friends, right?
Yeah, it's not about you, pumpkin. And you know what? I will mutter that to myself in times of, you know, something wonderful happening or you know, a criticism. It's not about you. You know, I just have to keep going and telling these stories that I feel like I was meant to tell.
And speaking of telling stories, is there a book that you've written that you wish more people would discover?
Huh. Well, I do feel like I've been ridiculously fortunate in being, you know, having the books read. I do think of Tiger Rising as kind of like my shy child. It's a, you know, feel like it's sandwiched in between two baton twirling overachievers, you know, Lynn Dixon and Tale of Despero. And so it's such a quiet book, but I also know and have talked to so many teachers who use that book to such profound effect in the classroom about talking to kids about grief and the suitcases and of what they put in their suitcase. And so I just, I can't ask for anything more. You know, that's kind of how I feel. Yeah.
That's fair. And yeah. Kind of staying in that same vein, is there a book that you wish you had written?
Oh, so many. yeah. And, you know, those books that I love and that I come back to and that are like the, you know, lamps that are held up for me. And so it's not, I've gotten over my, I wish that I had could do this, and rather like, let me read this again and see how they did that, you know. And one of them is always E.B. White's Charlotte's Web. And I'm always trying to figure out how he did that. And I never have come to any conclusion other than he puts his word, his heart on each word of that book. And so it's just like, that inspires me to try to do the same with what I'm doing, you know. It's rest my heart on each word of the book.
And I was just saying before our interview started, I said, after kind of doing some research, I loved Charlotte's Web as a child, and I read it multiple times, but I have not read it as an adult. And I said, I'm going to go back and read Charlotte's Web.
You know? Yeah, and I never read it as a kid because I read Black Beauty. And from that point on, I was just really wary of any book with an animal on the cover. I was so devastated by what happened to Black Beauty. And I would look at, again, you know, flashbulb memory, the spin rack at the library, the Yearling Newberries and the paperbacks, you know, that were in there. And I would look at Wilbur's face and think, yeah, no, not me. I was like, whoa. And he looks so worried on the cover, Wilbur does, you know. And so I didn't read it until I was like 30 something years old.
Well, Kate, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today and for the work that you do to give readers the opportunities of connection. The world is a better place because of your stories, and I agree with the masterful Ann Patchett. We are better for reading them.
Thank you.
Yes,
it's been really moving to talk to y'all. I'm gonna go walk Ramona now and see if anybody else says anything about the big lamp book.
Yeah.